How do furnishings impact the health of people inside buildings? It's all well and good designing and building a healthy, energy efficient, sustainable building, but what about all the stuff that we put inside that building? G'day and welcome back to another episode of Homestyle Green. This is the podcast dedicated to inspiring people to make a better place to live. And welcome to 2021. I had a great break and just actually recorded an interview this year, so it's great to get back behind the microphone. I have been looking at my plans, got some exciting stuff happening for me personally this year, looking at doing some study along with my work and wondering a little bit how I'm going to fit everything in. But I had the opportunity to speak with Susan Inglis recently, who's the Executive Director of the Sustainable Furnishings Council. Now, I'd never heard of the Sustainable Furnishings Council, and Susan was introduced to me, and it was a great chat, and it was really thought-provoking. It was a little bit outside the general realm of people that I speak to in terms of architects, designers, engineers, builders, but it's a really, really important issue because as we make our buildings more airtight, which we should be doing, we want to be making a better and better envelope to separate the outdoor environment from the indoor environment so that we have more control and that we can make our buildings an optimal temperature. We can also control relative humidity and control fresh air supply with good ventilation. But when we do that, it becomes increasingly important that we're careful with what we bring into our houses, because we can sometimes accidentally bring in all sorts of toxic chemicals like formaldehyde and other volatile organic compounds. They're the things like that new carpet smell, if you've ever had new carpet laid down, or the classic is a new car. That new car smell is actually really, really bad because it's a lot of it is formaldehyde and things that are off-gassing, which is why we can smell them. They're not things that we want to be inhaling because they can. A lot of them are toxic and they can accumulate in our bodies. And if we have a more airtight building envelope, then we need to be extra careful of that sort of thing. But buying things to fill up our homes also presents us with an opportunity to make sustainable choices. So it was great to meet with Susan and to find out about the work of the Sustainable Furnishings Council. I started out by asking Susan how she got involved in this industry in the first place. All right. Well, thank you, Susan, for joining us. It's a pleasure to chat with you. Before we get into the council itself, can you give us a quick introduction into you and how you got into what you're doing today?
Yes, I am happy to tell that story. Thank you for the opportunity and for your interest. I have been involved with Sustainable Furnishings Council since it began with an introductory or an exploratory meeting, I should say, in September of 2006. And here is why I happened to be at that meeting. I am a North Carolina native. I come from a family who appreciates stewardship. So I grew up with that appreciation. And it happened that by 2006, I had evolved and was running a small business of my own called From the Mountain, working with artisans around the world to get their skills and their products to new markets. So this would involve working with them to provide help in product development, to provide help in connections to markets, and to provide help in entrepreneurship skills development. And it happened that I was putting a lot of products in the residential furnishings industry, and the High Point Market in North Carolina is an important event for that industry. So through involvement in that event, I heard that there was going to be a meeting to talk about maybe starting what might become Sustainable Furnishings Council. And I thought, now that is likely to be good for my business and is certainly congruent with my interests in stewardship of ecosystems and of production methods that have evolved in harmony with those ecosystems. So I showed up for that meeting and I got involved and soon was so involved in this budding organization that the little business eventually was pretty much eclipsed, though it does still exist to some extent. So there's where I am coming from and how I got involved.
So was there a market already at that stage? It sounds like there was an interest in goods from sustainable sources, or was it just exotic sources with an interesting story that were going into sort of a high-end market?
There was some market for products from sustainable sources. The residential furnishings industry, home furnishings, is always interested in products with a story. And so when something is made far off the beaten path of interesting materials in relation to an interesting handcraft tradition, yes, that's interesting. But the most important story for residential furnishings is around comfort and style and value. Those are the things that actually sell a product. But yes, there was already some market for what we are now calling sustainable furnishings. It has certainly grown since our organization began.
And is that is it domestic or is it people importing goods from overseas?
Both. As I said, I'm in North Carolina, and here in North Carolina, the furniture manufacturing industry has been a significant part of our economy for over 100 years. But in recent decades, it has become the manufacturing itself has become a less important part of the economy as more and more manufacturing went abroad. And some of that manufacturing went abroad for fairly irresponsible reasons. They, you know, when environmental protection laws were stronger here in the U.S., companies went to another country where they could pollute with impunity. That has happened, and that has happened among furniture production companies. However, there is some manufacturing here in the U.S. that has stayed here, and there is some manufacturing that has gone abroad or that has been abroad right the way along that is just as responsible as you like, just as responsible as any other business would be.
Yeah, because I guess at the other end of that spectrum, I mean, the obvious is going off to a place like China where you can get things manufactured much more cheaply and with probably lax rules on the staff and personnel, but also where the materials are coming from. But I guess at the other end of the spectrum, there are things like trade aid that we have here where things are sourced ethically in pretty remote locations and with the purpose of being supporting often women, but other people who are working in villages in Africa or Indonesia somewhere, and actually paying a fair price for those products. Mm-hmm. And is there a question about what's more sustainable or what's more beneficial in helping those communities in a faraway place versus helping a craftsman carpenter just down the road?
Let me be sure I understand the question. It is definitely clear that working with women raises the local economy, raises the caliber of the local economy. That is indisputable. It is clearly proven over and over. So when any developed country is giving aid for business development, it is well known that giving that aid to women-owned enterprises will be most effective for building those local economies in disadvantaged areas. Is that what you were asking about, Matthew?
Well, a similar situation is I go to buy organic food at a grocer, local grocer, and it's beautiful organic food, but a lot of it comes from halfway around the world.
Right.
And the question comes up, is it more sustainable to buy something that's ethically sourced and is organic and is a really nice product, but it's been shipped quite a long way, versus going to my local market and buying something that doesn't necessarily have a certification? It's sort of, a parallel to that. Am I better off sourcing something that I'm supporting someone in a community far away that's their, might be reliant on that source of income, versus getting something that is produced locally by someone who's probably a lot better off?
Yeah. Yeah. The sustainability is an umbrella term, and because it's such a wide umbrella, these questions come up, and often the answer to the question is in one's own personal values. What is most important to you? Now, there are many facets to sustainability. So you could answer the question, what is most sustainable, by thinking just about carbon emissions. Well, if you do that, then it would be a really good idea to buy everything very local. In fact, there are many arguments for buying everything very, very local. One of the arguments for buying things from far away is that argument that we in our societies are prosperous enough to support the development of economies abroad, and that it is worth the transportation footprint of bringing something from a village in a more disadvantaged part of the world to where we are. But it does point to the fact that sustainability is a large area. What we're talking about when we're talking about sustainability is, what does it take for life as we know it, that is, life as prosperous society, prosperous citizens of prosperous societies, what does it take to sustain that? What decisions do I have to make? Do my communities have to make in order to ensure that my children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren can also live prosperous lives? Well, if all my decisions depend upon extraction of limited natural resources, then there is not going to be prosperity for my direct descendants. And even before that, there is not going to be prosperity for people in poorer parts of the world than where I live in the U.S.
What falls under the banner of furnishings?
All the things that we put in our homes that we might take with us if we were going to move away. So the furnishings includes the furniture, the decor like rugs or mirrors or even table linens. It is the stuff in your home that you would take with you when you move away. You might not take with you the carpet that is nailed down, down, but you probably would take with you the rug that you can roll up. So it's the furnishings mm-hmm. are the things that move around in a home.
Which I imagine adds up to quite a lot, and not something that a lot of architects and certainly a lot of builders would necessarily think about during the design and construction process. But I imagine it adds up to quite a lot of the overall impact of a build, but also, more importantly, for a lot of people, has a huge impact on the health of the interior environment.
Exactly. It does have a huge impact on the health of the interior environment. And frequently when the product is, for instance, finished with a finish that is still volatilizing, so there are volatile organic compounds coming off the furniture when it arrives at the consumer's home, that those volatile organic compounds can compromise the health of the residents of the home, but those volatile organic compounds likely have also compromised the health of the workers who made that piece of furniture. So there is a large health impact in how furnishings are finished, what chemicals go into them. There are 5 harmful chemicals that are commonly used in furnishings products, and they include VOCs like formaldehyde, which are found in finishes on furniture itself, on textiles, and on many products. Another of the 5 is flame retardants, which might be in the foam that is in upholstered furniture or in the fabric that is in upholstered furniture. And then there are the highly fluorinated chemicals, which are used in furnishings to resist stains and resist moisture. And so those are in textiles more than in anything else. And then there are antimicrobials, which are often in textiles. And then there's PVC, which is the world's most common plastic and shows up in lots of different applications in furnishings. Each of these 5 harmful sets of chemicals is linked directly to harm to human health and to other life on the planet, and each of them persists in the environment. So they're going to be around for a very long time. And if we're talking about sustaining a healthy future, we need to work on getting rid of them as soon as possible. And we need to do that carefully so that we don't replace them with something that also causes harm to our own health and the environment.
Yeah. And you've got some great resources on the Sustainable Furnishings website that I love the page, What's It Made Of Initiative.
Thank you.
Outlines those 5 areas of concerns. And you've also got there a supply chain questionnaire, which I'm guessing you encourage people to use to find out about whether those chemicals and products are present.
Exactly. And that questionnaire is very useful for industry professionals, so for designers or other specifiers. Consumers might find it easier to simply have a conversation with the salesperson, and the salesperson might not be able to answer all their questions very well. And so it would be at that point that they would bring in the questionnaire for it to be sort of run up the organization to get clear answers for them.
As an organization, that's a great resource, but do you have any other things that you point to, like you don't have any certification of your own, do you?
We don't. We do not have. Right. We feel like there are plenty of good certifications in the world, and we don't need another one, but we do need understanding of existing certifications, and we do need guidance in finding the certifications that are most pertinent for the decision we're trying to make. So we help consumers and industry professionals understand what certifications are pertinent when they're choosing products made of wood, or when they're choosing textiles, or when they're trying to avoid the harmful chemicals. So we point to existing certifications rather than having one of our own.
And are there some common ones of those that you often refer to?
I'm going to rattle some of them off for you. Yes. In wood, the most important certification is Forest Stewardship Council certification. Mm-hmm. And it is the most important one because it is always third-party certified, and because it covers the whole triple bottom line of sustainability and is designed to preserve ecosystems. And over the years, the other certifications, there are many, 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 many of them for wood. The PEFC, the Program for the Endorsement of Forest Certification, is a good guide for knowing which forest certifications besides Forest Stewardship Council certifications have merit. And so you can look for the PEFC mark to be assured that a national certification is robust. But PEFC is a desk review. So it is telling you about a certification that someone else developed and what their opinion of it is. Their opinion is good, right, but I do want people to understand that. So that's something for wood. Now, for textiles, I will point to Erkatex certification, and they have certification at different levels. They have a standard 100 and a standard 1000. They have many different ones, and they are all good because you can see very clearly what that certification is telling you about how the textile was made and even about how the fiber was produced. Another textile certification that goes from fiber to finished product is GOTS, the Global Organic Textiles Standard. And that is an excellent certification to look for. And I would especially encourage people to look for it in cotton. Cotton is particularly intensive, environmentally intensive to produce. And so you want to have a certification that heavy footprint has been lightened somewhat, at least. In the volatile organic compounds that might be coming off the surface of a textile or another, a table, even anything that is finished, a good certification to look for different levels of volatile organic compounds would be GreenGuard certification. And that does, and it's not the only one, but it is a certification for that single attribute, what is coming off the surface of the product.
Now, VOCs is a tricky area because it's a sort of a catch-all phrase, isn't it? Volatile organic compounds can be, and you mentioned formaldehyde, that is an example, and it's one of the worst.
Yeah.
Is there any way to easily distinguish between what the worst of the VOCs and some which are naturally occurring that potentially aren't as bad?
That's right. That's right. You're absolutely right that some VOCs are fairly innocuous. And so one thing that there is a tool, Green Screen, for interpreting different ways of looking at harmful chemicals, different lists of harmful chemicals, the red list of chemicals that might be listed on the REACH protocol, that kind of thing. And those and that is a useful tool. So that's what comes to mind first, Matthew, for that, because it does take research. It is, and that is why we think our work with the What's It Made Of initiative is so important. It is extremely complex, wading through tens of thousands of chemicals. And do you really need to know all that stuff? Well, we're thinking, well, let's start with what is most common in our industry and known to be persistent in the environment and linked to harm to human health and other life on the planet. So that's how we've come up with our list of the only five hazardous handful and a fairly simplistic way of looking for them and asking about their presence in the product.
That's some great resources there, and I'll put some links to those so that people can find them. And I'm guessing that in all of those that you refer, those certifications that you refer to, and the work that you do would make life easier for people who are working towards LEED certification, or particularly Living Building Challenge petals to do with no red list looking at that internal air quality stuff, which is often really, really hard because you have to chase all the paperwork. And you mentioned that going to us as a consumer, going to a supplier and not being able to answer those questions about what are the ingredients of this product here? Where do the things come from? And I think that's a really good question to ask, simply because it's often hard to answer. And the more people that start asking those questions, the more I hope it will encourage manufacturers to be able to answer the questions.
Exactly. So that's why we think simply asking what's it made of is important in itself. Whether you get a good, thorough, immediate answer or not, it's important to have asked the question. Yeah,
absolutely. Now, I just had a bit of a browse through some of your members and also some of the very experienced board members of your organization. A lot of them are involved in the industry and have got beautiful products that they supply through their various companies that they run in their day jobs, which kind of raises the question about beautiful furniture. Is it a niche market, and is thinking about sustainable furnishings something that only wealthy people can afford to do?
It is not something that only wealthy people can afford to do. Budget furniture brands are also looking carefully at their supply chains and trying to make better choices to sustain a healthy future. Now, it is true that attention on sustainability in the North American market, where I am, has caught on first in the luxury market, in the high end of the market, where consumers just love to consume a lot of stuff. And knowing that it has a valid eco story to the product makes them feel better about buying another product. The fact is that true sustainability does include buying fewer products when you have a choice. So it does include being careful about how we use our resources, taking responsibility for how resources on the planet are used. Now, for those who are far from the luxury market, who have trouble making large purchases such as of furniture, which is, of course, most of the people in the world, even in our very rich societies where we are, most people have trouble buying a new sofa or a whole new set of furniture for their bedroom or their dining room or whatever. They're lucky if they've got a bedroom or a dining room or whatever. There are more poor people in the world than rich people in the world by far. And so our thinking about good solutions for furnishing homes on a budget is extremely important. One of the things that we see can serve furniture retailers here in North America now, as we are hoping to go into a recovery from the impact of the COVID-19 slap to the economy, as we're hoping to go into that recovery, we see that furniture retailers could do well to not only sell new furniture, but also offer refurbishing services and also sell secondhand furniture. And this did happen in many furniture retailers in the old days. So a generation ago, the furniture store downtown was just as happy to reupholster your old sofa as to sell you a new sofa. And I believe we are going to see that returning. I believe we're going to see that happening again in communities across the world. I mean, it is happening more in some places already. It's happening in more European countries than here in North America at the moment.
That would be great to see that, particularly some of the older furniture, which is built to last and it might need reupholstering or a bit of a tidy up, but often solid wood, there's nothing wrong. It just doesn't, if you look after it, it doesn't deteriorate like some of the more modern manufactured materials.
Exactly. Yeah.
I also want to highlight your wood score.
Thank you.
Wood furniture scorecard. And I'm going to call out a couple of surprises on there, which maybe you can talk about. IKEA and Target. Didn't expect to see them there.
Yeah. this wood furniture scorecard is for scoring retailers on how well they are doing in sourcing wood furniture, specifically wood furniture. Why? Because the furniture manufacturing supply chain is very fragmented and it is very complex. And so the furniture industry is a place where illegally logged wood can be hidden. And inadvertently, a furniture retailer might be contributing to deforestation, probably somewhere far away from where they are, and they just have no idea about it. So this wood furniture scorecard is to raise awareness among those furniture buying teams and to support them in developing and in implementing really good policies for sourcing wood furniture. Well, it happens that IKEA was one of the companies that maybe 10 or more years ago, 10 or 12 years ago, they began to be aware of the importance of having a policy for sourcing wood because they got in trouble for having illegally logged wood in their supply chain. Neither you nor I will be able to tell whether it was in there because somebody made a mistake or because somebody was choosing the cheapest option. You know, that is unknown. But the fact is that it was highlighted, the Environmental Investigative Agency did an investigation and found out here's where some of this illegally logged wood is going. And that inspired IKEA to turn quickly to doing a better job of sourcing their wood. They are a huge, huge, huge company. So sourcing carefully is very important for the brand and is very challenging in a fragmented and complex supply chain. So they have earned their recognition with a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in the background, I imagine. There are also among the companies that have scored higher, some very small companies that you realize, of course, they are agile and are able to make decisions to buy furniture made very locally or in with materials that they have personal experience with. So you see, when you look at the companies that have scored high, some companies that have that kind of personal connection to their sources and some companies that have, and those personal connections have informed what their policy is. And in other cases, the policy has come first and has led the drive to new choices.
Yeah, yeah. Not to highlight those obvious ones that stick out too much. You make a very good point. There's some other really great small companies, so people should definitely have a look at that. And you've got a link to that furniture scorecard there on the website. There's a whole bunch of things there that we've already mentioned. What would you like to see consumers and also designers do? What are some tips and things, actions that you'd like people to take with regards to better decisions about what they fill up their homes with?
I would like consumers to realize that not only in furnishings, but in other products they consume, what it is made of, the materials and what has gone into making the product accounts for 80% or more of the environmental footprint of that product. So I would like consumers to be interested in knowing what it's made of and for that to lead to an interest in where it was made, how it was made, who made it, how did it get from their hands to the store where you're shopping now. I would like for consumers to be inquisitive like that and for them to do what I believe they do naturally, and that is bring their values with them when they're going shopping. So ask those questions and make choices that are in line with what's important to you, thinking about the thinking about sustaining a healthy future, not only for yourself in the coming years, but for generations hence.
And there you have it. Take your values with you when you go shopping. That's sound advice, I think, not just for procuring items to put in your home, but also just in general when we are consuming and deciding what to buy when we're out and about. That was Susan Inglis. She is the Executive Director of the Sustainable Furnishings Council. What do you think of that chat? I'd love to get your thoughts and feedback. You can email me, matthew@homestylegreen.com. I'd love to hear from you with your ideas for future shows and also just the general direction of the Homestyle Green podcast. Very interested in your thoughts on that. I thought there's some really good stuff in there. I really like the idea that the Sustainable Furnishings Council sees an important role in the industry, but hasn't gone and set up another certification, but in fact highlights the existing certifications that are out there and helps designers and people involved in the industry and consumers as well. They want to reach out to consumers to consider what we fill up our homes with. And this is becoming more and more important, particularly if we are getting more airtight, which we should be doing. You want to be making your buildings more airtight so that they are actually healthier, because airtightness helps you control temperature and humidity and actually decrease mold growth when you have a good ventilation system. But that means that you need to be extra careful with things like VOCs and formaldehyde that you're bringing into your home, which sneak in with all sorts of foams and fire retardants, all those things that Susan mentioned that can contain these chemicals that you might not be willingly bringing in, but can sneak in on other items. And it becomes more and more important. The more airtight our homes are, the better we build that envelope, which is a good thing to do. We just have to be extra careful about the things that we are bringing in so that we are maintaining that optimum health of the inside of our houses for us and our families. And of course, if you're involved in designing other buildings like schools, office buildings, workplaces, it's equally important for those places too. Well, that's it for this week. Looking forward to 2021. And like I said, really keen to get your thoughts and feedback. I really am grateful for people who reach out, and I've had some really nice feedback from people who get a lot from this show. So thank you very much for that. I really do appreciate it. That's it for this week. Now go make a better place to live. Hey, and don't forget, if you enjoy this show, you're going to love the Passive House podcast. Check it out at thepassivehouseaccelerator.com. That's passivehouseaccelerator.com, or just search for Passive House Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.